You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a person in Wisconsin is in isolation after having the first confirmed case of coronavirus here in the state. We'll talk about how things like quarantine and isolation work in Wisconsin and how public health officials make some of those decisions. First, to the non-scientists, science can be a little confusing. Cool, yeah, but it can be difficult to understand the latest research findings and how significant they really are. That's where science writers and reporters come in, bringing the compelling stories from the scientific world to the public while trying to capture the nuances of the latest research. And to help those journalists become better at their job or get into it in the first place, there's a new book. It's called The Craft of Science Writing, Selections from the Open Notebook. Madison-based science journalist Siri Carpenter edited that book. She's co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Open Notebook. That's a nonprofit resource for science writers. She joins me now in the studio. Siri, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Before we get into how science reporters work, can you flip things around to the people who read their work? Can you talk about the sort of things we get in the lay public from the work that you and your colleagues do?
Sure, absolutely. Well, as I'm sure you've seen, we are all just awash in information about science, and science really touches virtually every part of our lives. And it can be difficult to make sense of that. Not only is it complicated, but also there is a lot of misinformation floating around. There's fake news floating around, and it can be difficult to dissect all of that and understand it.
Seems like one of the biggest challenges for a science writer would be to take things from the world of science, which is sometimes there are gray areas. There's not necessarily a narrative. It might be a slight statistical difference here and there. Bring it into the world of journalism, where we want a story. We want a beginning and an end and a middle, and to make it work on both levels. How do you navigate that challenge?
That's absolutely right. That is a big challenge of science journalism, both making difficult material understandable, making it interesting, and giving people a balanced and nuanced sense of what's important, what they should be paying attention to, as well as making it entertaining.
Looking at the book and at the online open notebook, it seems clear that a lot of science journalists think a lot about what they're doing and want to get better at it. Can you talk about the origins of the open notebook a little?
Sure. The open notebook is a nonprofit that my friend and colleague Jeannie Erdman and I started just about 10 years ago, going on 10 years ago. And we started it because we wanted to get a glimpse behind the curtain about how some of the science writers that we admired most did their work. And so we started doing a series of interviews with science journalists to learn the stories behind the stories. And over time, we expanded the project to do other kinds of things as well.
Are there similar stories you hear from your colleagues out there in the world, the challenges that they keep running into again and again?
Yeah, over and over again, there are certain things that we hear. One is the challenge of understanding how to pitch a story to sell it to an editor in the first place. And what we always say is, if you want to tell your story to an audience, first you need to sell it to an editor. A lot of science journalists are freelancers, so that means that they're writing pitch letters to editors and hoping to be able to place a story so that they can get a contract to go and report that story. And that is a kind of a dark art, pitching, and so we try to shed light on that. Another aspect of science writing that I see over and over again and that I've experienced myself is what people call the imposter syndrome. This feeling that you just are not measuring up, and sooner or later you're going to be revealed as a fraud. And I think partly where that comes from is that we see what's going on inside our own heads. We're dealing with difficult, complicated material that takes time to understand and figure out, and then figure out how to write about it. And we worry that we're the only ones who are that confused, when in fact, that's what we're all experiencing.
Part of the challenge there, though, and you talk about this, and your contributors talk about this in the book, the idea that you want to think as much like a scientist as possible, maybe even be a scientist in some cases. You want to be as much of a journalist as possible, and those aren't always the same role, and it's hard to master both of them.
That's true. It's not the same role. Journalists, science journalists and scientists share a lot in common. Both professions are driven by curiosity about a search for some kind of truth, by a series of actions that you take to try to obtain information, test that information, report it out accurately. But science journalists are not, I mean, some may be trained as scientists, but their role is not to be scientists, and their role is also not to simply translate science for lay people. It's not to simply strip out the jargon and make something understandable, but rather to bring analysis and critical thought to what they're reporting on.
Right. And something I see a lot in science reporting is, okay, we're talking to the people who did this particular research. Now we go to other people, other experts in the field, and talk to them. And, you know, they may poke holes in it. They may agree. They may put it into context, into a wider context of the other research that's out there. So you're contributing something beyond just, here's what this research says.
Exactly. You're trying to do some kind of synthesis and analysis and bring your own observations from doing that reporting to the work that you're bringing to the public.
Talking to Siri Carpenter, editor-in-chief of the nonprofit resource for science writers called The Open Notebook. She is the editor of the new book, The Craft of Science Writing, Selections from The Open Notebook. Well, we have a big science story in the news here in Wisconsin, coronavirus, something I wonder about. I'm not a science writer, but we talk about science issues and disease issues. How do we talk about this in a way that's serious but doesn't exaggerate threats, doesn't needlessly scare people? How do you wrestle with that issue?
That's a really good example of an area where it's important for people who want to be critical consumers of information about science to have some understanding of how to think about science and how to think about how journalists do their work. As you know, just this afternoon, we learned that we've now seen the first case of the coronavirus in Wisconsin. And it's something that will probably throw some people into kind of a panic. And so it's important for people to understand, how do you think about risk when we're thinking about health risks or any kind of risk? What's the right way to think about your own risk or the risks facing your community or your family? In our book, there's a chapter that talks about reporting on risk and about how people who are reporting on risk, journalists who are reporting on risk, have to gather information, have to dispel misinformation, have to find the right experts in order to understand the true nature of risk, have to think about things like, with the coronavirus, how does this risk that an individual in Wisconsin might face of being infected with coronavirus, how does that compare with, say, their risk of being infected with the seasonal flu, which at this point is still much greater, of course.
And how do you and other contributors deal with that wider issue of risk? We might say the chance of disease X is doubled by this behavior. That can mean a lot of different things given what the initial risk is. How do you contextualize
that? That's exactly right. That's this concept of relative risk and absolute risk is the term that scientists use. If you have double the chance of such and such disease outcome, if you are, let's say, if you're a smoker and the initial risk is 0.00000001%, and then it's doubled, that's very different than if the initial risk was, you had a 25% risk and now you have a 50% risk. And so when we talk about risks, whether they're health risks or environmental risks, we have to be able to understand that difference in order to really convey the magnitude and meaningfulness of the risk.
Now, a fun part of the book, sometimes there's a science story like coronavirus that, okay, we see this as a story. But a fun part for you and some of the other people in the book is when you see that thing, it's not front page news, but you get that whiff that there's something interesting here. There's a story here. What's your radar for that? How do you detect those?
Right. When you just have a feeling that you have to tell this story, and sometimes you don't know exactly what it is.
Like a panda is one example.
Right. Yeah, right. That's right. There's a story by Maggie Kurth-Baker that Ed Yong interviewed her about this panda named Pan Pan, who was described as the panda that was really, really good at sex.
Right.
And it's the progenitor of many of the pandas living in captivity today. And Maggie was initially asked to write this article for 538 that would just be a small little database explainer. And it turned into this long project that really blew up into something really beautiful and much more narrative. And it was just something that she couldn't let go the more she dug into it.
Another great point, just at our last minute, if you're writing a crime story about a shooting, one of the contributors gives us an example, I can't remember which one, you don't have to explain to somebody what a gun is. If you're doing something on neutrinos, you could say it in a sentence, but then you have to establish what the things are to begin with.
That's right. Yeah, the explaining things part of science writing is both one of the joys and one of the frustrations, I think, for every science writer, explaining complex processes and figuring out how little can you get away with explaining, because you could go down a rabbit hole and you could explain every little detail about a process and write a PhD dissertation on it. But that's not normally what your job is as a science writer. And so figuring out how can you, what are the basics that your readers need, and what can you give them to make sure that they can understand and appreciate the story without putting them to sleep.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us. A great insight into the world of the science writer.
Thank you very much.
That's Madison-based science journalist Siri Carpenter. She's co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Science Writing Resource. It's online. It's called The Open Notebook. And we talked to her today about a new book that she edited, The Craft of Science Writing, Selections from The Open Notebook. If you have a favorite piece of science writing or science writer, let us know about it. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at how public health officials handle quarantines here in Wisconsin after the first case of the coronavirus, as we were just talking about, was confirmed in the state today. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump delivered his third State of the Union address last night. There were some surprising moments. We'll break it down and find out what it could mean for the 2020 presidential election campaign. First, Wisconsin now has the first confirmed case of coronavirus in the state, with one person in isolation as of today. The virus originated in Wuhan, China, and has killed close to 500 people there. The Wisconsin case, though, marks only the 12th in the U.S. to date, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cautions that U.S. cases so far have only been from travel to part of China or from close contact with people who have been there, and that the virus is not currently spreading among American communities. Patrick Remington is professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to WPR host Keely Baltina earlier today about how the quarantine process works here in the state.
We've been hearing a lot about quarantines out of China. When the U.S. enacts a quarantine, what does that really look like?
Well, that's a great question. It's important to understand the difference between quarantine and isolation. We use isolation in public health to put a person who's infected and has the potential to infect others in a place where they won't spread the disease. So oftentimes it's in a isolated hospital room or isolated to home. Quarantine's a different concept. Quarantine is putting somebody in isolation, in effect, but they don't have the disease. They've been potentially exposed to the disease, so you worry that they might spread later during the time when the organism is incubating, but we don't know for sure that they have the disease. We suspect they do. That's why they're being quarantined, but we don't know for sure.
It feels like if you had something, maybe it's easier to understand why you would be isolated then. I mean, we're seeing entire cities being quarantined overseas because of this concern.
And that's one of the challenges, sort of the ethical or legal question with quarantine, in that a person who has an infectious disease like tuberculosis or the coronavirus, you can pretty easily understand why they would be put in isolation. They're at risk of spreading it to others, and there's a strong legal basis to do that. But quarantine is taking people who might have been in the same room with a person with the disease, or might have been in the same airplane, or might have just been in the same airport. And how far you extend that envelope of concern is a judgment call. And clearly in China, they've decided to be very broad in their quarantine orders to make sure they stop this from spreading. But in a place where there hasn't been much human-to-human transition and where you have a sense that you have the outbreak under control, you could be more limited in the use of quarantine.
When we focus on Wisconsin, are there rules about when health officials can enact quarantine?
Well, this is both the science and art of public health. There are guidelines that the CDC provides, and it would be different for different communicable diseases. But it's really an interpretation of the professionals that we have at the state and local level to use their judgment as to the potential for risk. So if a person was, again, a good example would be in an airport, you might say that the airport is large and that I'm really only concerned about people who were on that same airplane. But if it's a smaller airport, maybe with concern that the person traveled, you know, from the restaurant to the restroom and on, then you might be broader. So it really is contact tracing. That's a really important part of this, to trace all of the contacts of the person who has the disease and then understand what their patterns of travel have been. So it's a really hard thing to do. It's really complex. And you don't want to be so cautious to quarantine an entire community or entire city when that's not necessary.
Because then you're isolating that whole community of people who may not have been exposed but were feared to be exposed are then kind of trapped. They're stuck there where they could actually experience exposure then.
Yeah, that so you may increase the person-to-person transmission. But I think the general reason not to is it's like crying wolf, that if it turns out that that wasn't necessary, the disease does not spread to any individuals who'd been quarantined, then it means you were too cautious. And the next time, the public may not be so amenable to a public health intervention.
Who has to make these decisions? You mentioned some state and local officials. Who makes the call?
Well, it depends on where the virus is traveling. If the virus is moving across state lines or coming in from our border, then that's the role of the federal government. And the CDC is our nation's public health agency. But the Constitution gave public health authority to the states for any infectious disease problems or any health problems within the borders of the state. So if it's an infection within Wisconsin, then it would be up to our state health department. And Wisconsin is a state with relationships with county health departments, and they delegate to county health departments that authority. So it really is within the state, a partnership between local and state public health officials, and then nationwide, a partnership between state health departments and the federal government, the Centers for Disease Control.
Patrick Remington is professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and we're talking about quarantines and the difference between quarantines and isolations and who gets to make the decisions, how it affects people. Patrick, what are some of the things that go into that decision to figure out how much of an area or community to quarantine or isolate?
Well, if we were dealing with an infectious disease that we really understood very well, for example, measles, then we would have fairly well-established principles of assessing risk exposure. Measles happens to be one of the most, if not the most, contagious infectious diseases that we know of. So there the quarantine order may be quite broad to anybody who was in not only in contact with that individual, but we know the measles virus can stay in a room for up to a couple hours after the individual leaves. If it's a less contagious organism that requires really person-to-person contact, touching, or direct contact with a sneeze or droplets, then we might be more cautious. The problem with the coronavirus in this outbreak is that we're still trying to figure out the epidemiology and the infectivity of it. And since we don't know, I think many places are being cautious, assuming that it could be more contagious than it might actually turn out to be.
Let's put the coronavirus in some context. I mean, we know about past outbreaks. We've heard of SARS or MERS. Where are we with the coronavirus and how much of a threat it might be globally?
Well, we still don't know. We do know quite a bit about the other two coronaviruses, SARS and MERS. And through extensive epidemiologic investigations, we found out that they had quite a high mortality rate. For every 100 people infected, SARS might kill 10 of them, and MERS even more, maybe 20 or 25. That's a very serious infection. Right now, I saw as of today, the estimate for the case fatality rate for the Wuhan coronavirus is around 3-4%. But again, that could vary depending on how much more research we do. But in context with the previous outbreaks, it seems to be less of a fatal illness than MERS and SARS.
And when we're thinking about infectious disease in Wisconsin, have we seen quarantines in the past?
Well, we know we've seen quarantines nationally. But the last one was, or the last significant one was back in 1917 and 18 during the global flu pandemic. I think outbreaks might be handled at the local level and such that there are really small outbreak investigations where you might do this not on a formal way by having a quarantine order, but simply working within the health community and saying if somebody's been exposed, it's better that these individuals stay at home, for example, until we know whether they're going to be ill or not. I'm not aware of any statewide quarantine orders within Wisconsin in the recent past.
Milwaukee public health officials told our colleagues at Wiscontex that they would consider less restrictive means than a quarantine if they could still protect public health. It sounds like those are the types of things you're talking about. What would less restrictive means maybe look like?
Well, again, it's the advice that we give right now to everybody. There are other communicable disease circulating. Influenza is circulating. So practical things that people can do if you're ill and you're coughing, please don't come to class or get on an airplane. If you're on an airplane with somebody who is apparently ill and looks like they might have a contagious disease, I read this morning the advice is don't sit next to them. If you do, you might be 80% have an 80% chance of getting infected. If you don't, it might be reduced to only 10 or 20%. So I can imagine they're not the most popular people on an airplane today, those people who are coughing and really ill. So the best advice is if you're ill, isolate yourself by staying at home. And if you're not ill, use common practices, hand washing, good personal hygiene to reduce the risk of transmission.
Patrick, thank you so much for breaking that down for us.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Remington, professor emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked earlier today to WPR host Keely Baltina about how the quarantine process works in Wisconsin and how public health officials get ready for things like the coronavirus. You can find a story about this from our colleagues at WisContext. That's linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, we'll look at some of the big moments in last night's State of the Union address at the nation's capital and the Democratic response. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up with Brexit now a reality, we'll find out what it can mean for Wisconsin trade with the European Union and with the United Kingdom. First, President Trump gave his third State of the Union speech last night, and the partisan tension was on full display. Both Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi traded snubs. First, when President Trump apparently declined to shake Pelosi's hand right before his speech, that after the speech was over, Pelosi ripped up a paper copy of the address in front of the cameras. Kathy Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. She's also co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Political Science. Kathy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, before we go on to the content of the speech and the Democratic response last night, let's talk about that tension I just mentioned between the president and the speaker. What stood out to you about that? What do you make of all that?
Well, I don't think it's surprising. I think that the president, you know, was advised to make no reference of impeachment and to, you know, sort of keep the focus on the kinds of things he wanted to deal with in the State of the Union. But, you know, in some ways it's impossible to completely control those instincts, and he and the speaker have not had a good relationship for the last several months. So I think we obviously saw that on you know, both ends of the speech in those two exchanges. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're human beings, and I think some of those kinds of things are going to come out.
Now, this is a State of the Union address coming out. Often this is the biggest news story of the week, but it comes the eve of this Senate impeachment vote. It comes right after the Iowa caucuses and sort of during the Iowa caucuses, since the results are still coming out, and the surprise kind of from Mitt Romney. Is this a State of the Union that's going to get swallowed up in the news cycle faster than usual?
Yes, I would say so. I think it already has. You know, I was looking at the internet this morning, looking at various news sites, and it was all focused on reviewing the speech. And then by about 1 o'clock this afternoon, you know, lunchtime or so, all of the major publications and newspaper outlets were focusing on the end of the impeachment trial and the speeches that were being made in Washington. So I do think that for a few hours there was some attention to this, but I don't know that there's necessarily going to be much reflected, you know, glow or bounce that the president gets out of this.
Now, the president and his team set up some surprise moments here. I want to give a listen to one of them, a reunion between a woman named Amy Williams, whose husband had been serving in the military overseas with him and their children. Here's a listen.
There is one more thing. Tonight we have a very special surprise. I am thrilled to inform you that your husband is back from deployment. He is here with us tonight, and we couldn't keep him waiting any longer.
There's been this growing trend over the years, first of having special guests that the president will allude to during the speech, and that seems to have gotten bigger and bigger over the years, and now this moment, Kathy.
Well, I would say that nobody has done in a State of the Union the kinds of things that the president did last night. So, yes, we have a history of guests in the gallery, but this is something new and different. You know, think what you will about the president, but he is a show person, and he does seem to, you know, want to run the office like it is a reality TV show. So I think both the awarding of the medal to Rush Limbaugh last night and then the reunion of this family in the clip you just played are perfectly designed to play to the audience watching television, you know, the surprise, the gotcha, the kind of thing that people watch TV shows like The Bachelor for and other kinds of things like that. So I think as somebody, you know, who studies political science, I think that I saw this as sort of more evidence of, you know, the celebrity notion of politics and making everything like a, you know, a popular game show. It was certainly an important moment for that family, but I think it's important to remember that that family was separated for any number of hours before the big reveal because that man, you know, had been brought to Washington earlier in the day. So it was a blatant attempt to play on emotion, and I think that will play positively with some and not so well with others.
Kathy Dolan is with us, distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at yesterday's State of the Union address. Let's get into some of President Trump's economic message, will be a big part, potentially, of his campaign. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say about the economy.
3 years ago, we launched the Great American Comeback. Tonight, I stand before you to share the incredible results. Jobs are booming, incomes are soaring, poverty is plummeting, crime is falling, confidence is surging, and our country is thriving and highly respected again.
Kathy, can you talk about the importance of the economy for President Trump's reelection campaign?
Well, the economy is usually the most important issue for a president, regardless of, you know, campaign or not campaign perspectives. It's one of the primary issues on which the public evaluates the job that a president is doing, that and sort of international and foreign affairs. So the president is certainly going to use the economy as a primary issue in his reelection campaign. He talks about the economy a lot. Obviously, last night that was the focal point by far. But as with all things with this president, we have to remember that almost none of the things he said last night were actually true. And so he is a good case study in somebody who says words, and large swaths of the country believe him when he says those words. But anybody could look at any reputable media source today and see the list of all of the things that he said last night that just simply aren't true.
A lot of Democrats and others, some economists, point toward economic trends that the president referred to as being true in part, but as having started about 2 years into the Obama administration, trends on things like unemployment and economic growth, oil production in the United States, that kind of thing. Is that something that matters, though, for voters? Is a good economy going to benefit the president now?
Well, you know, the economy is good and is strong, and as you say, a lot of the trends to which he refers did start several years ago. We know that the economy is not growing as rapidly now as it did during the last few years of the Obama administration, but, you know, as you say, the president doesn't focus on that. We also know that presidents don't really have as much direct control of the economy as people seem to think that they do. So while President Trump has put us into different trade agreements with countries and has done a lot of tariff work in our relationship with China in some ways that have a direct impact, the average person believes the president to be much more in control of the economy than he or she perhaps someday ever would be. So the president will get some credit, obviously, for the health of the economy. Many people will overstate, you know, his control of the economy and may give him sort of outsized credit for that. And while people focus on the economy because it is really important both to their own lives and to national conditions, most people don't understand a lot of the important indicators. You know, they'll hear that the stock market is going up or they'll hear that unemployment is low. But a lot of those economic indicators aren't as central to the lives of most Americans, in part, say, as an example, because the average American doesn't have money tied up in the stock market. And so the economy can be a mixed bag for presidents, but he will certainly get credit for the health of things, you know, given that some people won't understand the parameters.
Did you see much from the president when it came to bipartisan proposals, things that both parties could maybe get behind?
Well, you know, there weren't a lot of real policy proposals. I mean, a State of the Union address is often kind of a laundry list of proposals that a president would like Congress to work on. In an election year, it does tend to become more of a here's what I've done retrospective and here's why you should love me and look forward to reelecting me. There were a couple of policy pieces in the speech. He talked a little bit about school choice. He talked a little bit about transportation policy. He talked about a ban on late-term abortion, keeping the cost of prescription drugs low. So, you know, a couple of those things, I mean, I think everyone would support the idea of lower prices on prescription drugs. Lots of people probably liked the toss-out he made about neonatal research funding. But there weren't a lot of bipartisan elements to the speech, and there really weren't just a lot of policy elements to the speech.
I want to give a listen to part of the Democratic response. This came from Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan.
All across the country, Democratic leaders are rebuilding bridges, fixing roads, expanding broadband, and cleaning up drinking water. Everyone in this country benefits when we invest in infrastructure.
That was part of the theme, Democrats getting things done around the country. Also talk about health care. What did you see in the response message there from the Democrats?
Well, I think what the governor was trying to do is really to stay on message with regard to what the Democratic Party, at least at large, has decided is a good strategy for them. If you think back to the 2018 midterm elections, Democratic candidates across the country really tried to focus on health care and the economy and the kinds of things that people care about in their daily lives. And this frame of getting things done is a way, I think, that the party has decided is probably a good contrast to President Trump, in part because President Trump is so much more just sort of like visual and verbal, and people don't think about, you know, policies as much with regard to him in a daily context. And the Democrats were largely quite successful in the congressional elections in 2018. And so I think they do believe that what we refer to as the pocketbook issues, you know, of people's daily lives, is going to be one of the best themes for them to pursue in 2020 as they're trying to convince voters, you know, to look at them more closely.
Talking to Kathy Dolan, political scientist at UW-Milwaukee. We're breaking down last night's State of the Union address and the Democratic response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to the speech last night or read the transcripts this morning? If so, what did you make of it? What stood out to you about the content, the tone, the delivery, the controversy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about last night's State of the Union speech from President Trump. Kathy Dolan is with us, political scientist at UW-Milwaukee, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does the president's message about the economy reflect what's happening in your own life? Do you want to see more wall construction going on? Do you agree or disagree with what you heard from the president? What do you think it all means for the 2020 presidential election? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Nate joins us from Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I was going to repeat a point that I thought was very valid, in that you had a Tuskegee Airman and Rush Limbaugh, and the wrong one was given a medal by the president. Specifically, the Tuskegee Airman risked himself for his country, and Rush Limbaugh, not only did he dodge the draft, but he made a career basically out of lying to people on the air. And in specific, one of the more recent lies was claiming that Republicans couldn't cross-examine witnesses in the impeachment thing, which helped Trump, but if you look at PolitiFact, is actually very wrong.
Nate, thanks for the call. The Tuskegee Airmen got a military honor. Rush Limbaugh got one reserved for civilians. But Kathy, a lot of reaction to that award for the broadcaster Rush Limbaugh.
Yes, I think that it was, you know, I think it's fair to say it was a controversial choice. I think, you know, lots of people would think it was a touching tribute to Rush Limbaugh after he announced that he had cancer. But I think other people will be very offended that somebody who has a long track record of racist and homophobic and misogynistic comments, and as your caller suggests, you know, is somebody who is part of the right-wing media machine that is not always accurate, giving him the highest civilian honor that our country can bestow, you know, for some people is going to feel uncomfortable. And I think, to return to my earlier point, that it was part and parcel of President Trump's desire to have something, you know, jazzy and exciting and game show-like at the State of the Union. And, you know, I'm sure he was poking it in the eyes of, you know, Democrats and people in the country watching.
Right. That's, I mean, President Trump, whether you like the strategy or not, definitely is willing to make controversial statements or gestures like this. I think it's fair to say with the hope that it'll get reaction from his critics. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. No, I think President Trump is somebody for whom doing something and not getting a reaction is about the worst thing that could happen. So, yes, everything he does in that regard and in his campaign environments is absolutely calculated for maximum impact. And I certainly have no way of knowing the president's mind, but I don't think that on Friday last week the White House was thinking about giving Rush Limbaugh this Medal of Honor. I think this is all, you know, specifically because he announced on Monday that he is ill and dying. And then they went into gear and said, oh, and we can do this and make a spectacle. So I think, you know, people in our country need to decide for themselves whether that's appropriate or, you know, the right way for the government to give out honors.
And people have made a similar comment about Speaker Pelosi's gesture of tearing up the script afterward. Whatever people think about the decorum of that or whatever, one of the most striking images, the most viral images, was of her, not of him. And we can't read anyone's mind, but could you see this as a calculated move to kind of capture some of the spotlight and take some of it away from the president?
Well, it certainly could have been a calculated attempt on her part to communicate her feelings about the speech, absolutely. I mean, again, we can't know. I mean, certainly the Rush Limbaugh moment was calculated and staged. Whether hers was a reaction born out of frustration after listening for an hour and a half to the president say lots of things that were not true, and she was just disgusted, or whether she went into the speech planning to do that. I mean, we can't know, but it certainly did get attention. And again, you know, one side will think that she showed no grace in doing that, and the other side will say, well, you know, when you've listened to somebody lie about you for an hour and a half, that's kind of the frustration you exhibit. I do think, you know, as we said earlier, that it really shows the sort of continued antagonism of politics in Washington in our current state.
We're talking to Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at yesterday's State of the Union address. Back to your calls. Anne is with us in Amory. Anne, hi.
Hi there. I want to thank you, first of all, for having me, and I really enjoy this program. It's
Thanks.
Very enlightening. So thank you so much. But my concern, among many, is about this wall that he was bragging about, how he was building it. And, of course, we know it's with private funding because he's not getting any money from our government to do this. But I'm wondering how he's acquiring the land upon which he's building this. And I don't believe that people who are for it have any idea of what it's looking like and how it's blocking and taking away people who have property along the river.
And thanks a lot for the call. A lot of details about there about the wall. A lot of the construction is, I think, already on existing government land with some barrier there already. But Kathy, staying with the State of the Union, can you talk about what the president talked about when it came to a border wall? That was a big part of his original campaign, of course.
Yes, yes. President Trump in his campaign in 2016 certainly made immigration and building a wall between our country and Mexico as a cornerstone of that, and has continued. If you look at each of his States of the Union address, he has made immigration a centerpiece. And in talking about the wall last night, he talked about how it has kept us safe and it is keeping us from having too many people come to this country. I think at some level he's sensitive about the wall, because if you remember in the last week or two, there have been several reports about the sort of shoddy construction and the ways in which there are places where the wall has to be kept open because of floodplains and things like that. Take whatever position you want on whether it's a good idea, and that's up to listeners to decide. But the wall, as it has been constructed in many places in the last 3 years, is not as successful as it could have been. So it's certainly possible that he wanted to focus on it from what he sees as a more positive perspective. And he knows that, again, people who support him in part because of his stronger stand on immigration and want to hear those things, right? He was speaking last night to the people in the room, certainly, but much more to the people who were watching him. And he wants to make sure that he is telling his supporters about the successes and the progress on the issues about which they care.
Time for one more caller. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I thought it was a very good speech. The president, he talked about illegal immigration, but the border crisis would have never happened had the Democrats had the policy that they have. If we would have had a closed border, there would have been no border crisis. There'd be no free health care that our children have to pay for. Okay, so I'm just saying I like the speech.
Mary Kay, thanks a lot for the call. A support of the president's policies there. Kathy, immigration and border control, a long issue that's long-running issue that's plagued both parties in Congress over the years.
It is. Immigration is a thorny issue in the United States. I don't want to let Mary Kay's call go without saying that her belief that people in this country illegally get free health care that her children pay for is absolutely incorrect. Setting that aside, immigration is an issue that both parties struggle with. We have always been a nation of relatively free borders, right? We are a nation of immigrants. the two parties, certainly in the contemporary period, take different stands on how we should manage immigration. I think the Democrats are certainly not for free and open borders. They want controlled immigration, but they want it in a different way than does the president. And I think the president and the current Republican Party are much farther along the line of a closed border country, or at least being very, very selective about who is allowed to emigrate to this country. So I think Mary Kay gives us a good example, right? People who support the president believe what he says about immigration, and they like what he says. And whether there's truth to the things he says or not, one of his great appeals to voters is that he says what a lot of them feel and believe, and they think they have a champion in him.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. And Kathy, that's all our time. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today to talk about last night's State of the Union address from the president and the Democratic response, what we may have learned a little bit about the President Trump's 2020 reelection strategy. Still time for you to weigh in. You can share your thoughts, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's an opportunity for you. You can be a frustrated, angry airline passenger in a busy metropolitan airport experiencing some kind of crisis, big or small. Sounds terrible? Well, hold on. You're just pretending. As reported in the LA Times, the Los Angeles International Airport is getting ready to open a new terminal, and they're looking for volunteers to take it for a test drive. They want people of all ages, and some of them are going to play special roles as passengers with, say, kids having a meltdown or angry passengers frustrated that they're running late for their planes. They'll run a few hundred of those volunteers through the concourse as if they're trying to catch actual flights. The goal is to make sure the signage is right, figure out how much staffing is needed, and so on. You can apply to be a volunteer on their website. Now you're thinking, this is LA. They have lots of aspiring actors out there who would love a role like this. Why would they want some Wisconsinites showing up? But I say those local LA actors are going to waste lots of time asking questions like, what's my motivation? Who is this character? What's my backstory? Now, we're going to show up and we'll put in a good day's work for our pay, which, since it's a volunteer thing, is nothing, plus beverages and a meal. And we can be sure they're ready to deal with important questions like, where's the nearest bubbler? This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.